Powerful. A dangerous man to cross. He owns the only olive press, and he lets those he likes or to whom he owes favors get the best time to press their olives. If he does not like you, if you refuse to sell your trees to him, like me, then you find that your time to press olives is at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Does the press run day and night?
It does. In the peaking season, the sooner the olives are pressed, the better. So each person wants time at Cosimo's press.
So what was Gianni doing that might anger Cosimo? I asked.
He still has olive trees over beyond the old monastery. Cosimo never liked him, and he always gives Gianni the worst times. Sometimes he makes him wait for days. So Gianni was trying to get together with some of the local farmers to set up a co-op and build their own olive press. I don't know how far he has come with this idea, but of course Cosimo would be angry if anyone tried to go against him.
Gianni is a fool, Angelina said. He likes to talk big, but if he came to a showdown with Cosimo, he would run away with his tail between his legs. While we talked, Paola carried in dishes and placed them in front of us.
Asparagus from the garden, she said. It is asparagus season. Such a short time that we make the most of it and eat asparagus at almost every meal.
She placed a dish of white stalks in front of me, then drizzled them with olive oil and grated Parmesan cheese over them from a big block. I had eaten asparagus before, certainly not often, as it was a delicacy in England, but it had tasted nothing like this. Each mouthful was heavenly, the sharpness of the cheese contrasting with the sweetness of the vegetable. After we had finished this course, Angelina cleared away the plates and returned carrying a big tureen. When Paola took off the lid, the herby aroma filled the room. She served me a generous portion, much bigger than I would have liked, but it would have been rude to refuse.
Here we are, the peachy you and I made this afternoon, and the rabbit ragout. Enjoy.
And I did enjoy. Somehow I seemed to find room to clear my plate. There was just enough of the rabbit in the sauce to flavor it, but it was the herbs and tomatoes that made it so delicious. I resolved to learn about herbs from Paola before I departed, and if ever I had a garden, I'd grow them myself. After the main course had been cleared, biscotti were put on the table along with small glasses of a rich amber liquid.
"This is the Vin Santo I told you about," Paola said. "The holy wine."
I looked surprised. "This is really holy wine from the church?" She laughed.
"This is what we call it. No, it doesn't come from the church now. There are many stories about the name. Some say it was the style of wine from dried grapes favored for Mass. But others say there was a holy friar who used the leftover wine from the Eucharist to go around and cure the sick. These days, it just tastes good for dessert. This is how you eat the biscotti. You dip, and then you eat."
Angelina got up.
"I'm going to bed, Mama. I am tired. The little one kept me up most of last night. Please God, she sleeps for a while now."
Paola gave her a big hug and kisses on both cheeks. Angelina shook my hand, giving me a shy smile.
"Tomorrow, you must tell me about life in London," she said. "About the fashions, and the music, and the movie stars. I want to know everything."
"All right," I returned her smile. She picked up the little cradle and carried it from the room. After she had gone, Paola leaned closer to me.
"It is good to see her animated again," she said. "For a while after the baby, she showed no interest in anything. She was very ill, you know. They had to take the baby early, or she would have died. I thought I would lose her, my only child. But now, thank God and the Blessed Virgin, she is on the road to recovery."
She put a hand on my shoulder.
"You lost your poor mama, so you know what it feels like to lose someone you love. After my dear man, it would have been more than I could have borne. It's the very worst thing in the world for a mother to lose her child."
I felt tears welling up in my eyes and tried to swallow back a sob. The wine had worn at my defenses. I wanted to tell her. I wanted to tell somebody and have her arms around me,
telling me softly that she understood. But I stopped myself at the last moment. I couldn't tell even this sweet and kind woman how it felt to have lost my baby.
"Don't look so sad," she said, touching my cheek. "All is well. We are tested and we survive, and life will be good again."
With those comforting words, I bid her good night and went to bed. It was only when I was curled up in bed, feeling the cool touch of those soft sheets against my cheek, that I allowed the tears to come. I might have held them back until now, but I couldn't any longer. I relived every moment. I remembered my surprise when the doctor told me that I was pregnant. My initial fear was replaced with reassurance. The pregnancy was not planned, and had come sooner than we'd hoped, but Adrian would do the right thing and marry me. I'd put my clerkship with the solicitor on hold, that's all. But that wasn't what happened. Adrian had looked scared, then annoyed.
"Are you sure? It couldn't have come at a more inconvenient time, could it? We're both so close to taking our bar exams, certainly in no position to settle down and start a family."
He paused, a frown spoiling that smoothly handsome face. Then he relaxed again and gave me a little smile.
"Don't worry," he said. "It will be all right. I know someone who can take care of it."
It took me a while to realize that he wanted me to have an abortion. Shock, horror, revulsion. "An abortion? Is that what you were suggesting?" Adrian remained so calm.
"He's a good chap. Knows what he's doing."
"Adrian, it's our baby. How can you be like that?"
"Oh, come on, Joanna. It's the 1970s. Women have abortions all the time. It's no big thing anymore."
"It is for the baby," I said. "And it would be for me. My father would never forgive me if he found out."
"Your father has hardly been the most supportive man in the universe, has he?" Adrian demanded. "And hopelessly old-fashioned. He can't even accept our living together, for God's sake."
"All right," I said, taking a deep breath. "I could never forgive myself. There, I've said it. And if you care so little about me..."
"Of course I care about you," Adrian said. "It's just that I'm not prepared to wreck two lives for the sake of a baby neither of us wants."
He put a hand on my shoulder then.
"You're still in shock. Think about it, and I'm sure you'll come to see that my way is best."
I did think about it. I told myself that in truth, there was no other solution. Adrian would keep pressuring me if I stayed with him. He certainly wouldn't want to share his flat with an unwanted baby that might ruin his precious reputation. And if I moved out? I had no guarantee my father would take me in, and apart from him, I had no one. I think the biggest shock was realizing that Adrian, my Adrian, who I had thought was my soulmate, my lover, my best friend, was none of the above. He was someone I could no longer rely on. I told myself he was right. We were in no position to start a family. It was only a bit of tissue at this stage, not a baby. But I simply couldn't do it. Strangely enough, it was liberal free spirit Scarlett who was on my side. "Don't do it if you don't feel it's right," she said. "And don't stay with that creep Adrian if that's the way he treats you. You've got me. I'll help you get through it. And I bet your dad will too, once he gets used to it. Go and see him and tell him. He'll rant and rave a bit, but then he'll come around." "I don't know," I said. "You know what a fuss he made when I moved in with Adrian."
"But it's his only daughter in trouble. It's my betting he won't let you down. He'll want to look after you."
I agonized over this. Even if my father forgave me, I could never go and live with him. I imagined Miss Honeywell's horrified looks and the schoolgirls' giggles. There didn't seem to be any way out. I almost relented and went to tell Adrian he was right. Except that I couldn't. I wandered aimlessly around London, debating whether to go down to Surrey and see my father or not, trying to come up with some kind of solution. And I didn't see the taxi come speeding around the corner as I stepped out to cross King's Road in Chelsea. I remember the sensation of flying, then of lying on the pavement with faces staring down at me, and a kind man covering me with his jacket, and an ambulance.
then nothing much for a couple of days. Scarlett came to see me in hospital. She asked if she could telephone my father, but I didn't want her to. I felt too weak to face him. It wasn't until a few days later that I learned that among my other injuries, broken ribs, broken collarbone, a severe concussion, I'd had a miscarriage and lost the baby. I should have been relieved, but instead I wept. Adrian came to see me too, and sat on the side of my bed, holding my hand awkwardly and muttering pleasantries that it was all for the best, wasn't it? And I'd be as good as new in no time. Actually, it took quite a while for me to heal. I had dizzy spells, terrible headaches. It hurt me to breathe. Adrian came to see me daily at first, then less frequently. When I was due to come out of hospital, he came and sat at my bedside and said he thought it would be better if I went home to my father to recuperate. He had something he'd wanted to tell me for some time, but he'd waited until I was strong enough. He had fallen in love with someone else. He was going to get married, to the daughter of the senior partner at his law firm. And that was that. I collected my things and fled to the only safe haven I could think of, Scarlett's flat. She, bless her heart, welcomed me with open arms. She let me curl up on her sofa and recover, but I was still too fragile to go back to work. My solicitors were understanding to start with. They realized I'd had a bad accident and wished me well. But lately they'd made it clear that they wouldn't wait forever. The physical wounds were healed, but there was still a big, empty void inside me. It felt as if I had been going around like a shadow of my former self, like a hollow person with no clear purpose and frankly not much hope. What I wanted was my mother. I suppose my father had never allowed me to grieve properly when she died. We had to make the best of things and soldier on, to be a credit to the family. That was what I'd been told, and it was only now that I was grieving for her. I wanted someone like Paola to love me. Eventually, I cried myself to sleep. I awoke the next morning to the sounds of the countryside, a rooster crowing, a dawn chorus of birdsong. Sunlight was streaming in through slatted blinds. I got up feeling strangely energized and refreshed, looked at myself in the bathroom mirror, and was horrified at the puffy, misshapen face I saw staring back at me. I'd definitely need a shower before I allowed Paola to see me. I pulled on the shower handle. A small trickle of water came out and then stopped altogether. I thought maybe I'd got the mechanism wrong and tried turning it the other direction. Whatever I did, I could get no water. Frustrated now, I put on yesterday's clothes, brushed my hair, tried to cover my blotchy face with powder, and went to look at the well. Had the pump somehow ceased to function? The well was housed inside a wooden structure, the lid of it held in place with a large stone. I removed the stone, then tried to raise the lid. It was too heavy for one person to lift, or at least for me to do so. I tried several times, then gave up, admitted defeat, and went up to the farmhouse. I wondered if Paola would be awake this early, but as I approached the kitchen, I heard her singing. Through the open window, I watched her kneading dough at the table. Such a warm and comforting scene. I tapped on the back door so that she wasn't startled, then entered. She turned to me, a big, welcoming smile on her face.
"Ah, my little one, you are awake with the sun. Did you sleep well last night?"
If she noticed my face was not looking its best, she did not betray the fact. "I'm sorry to bother you," I said, "but the shower, it gives no water. I have turned the handle this way and that way and still no water. I tried to see if there is a fault with the well, but I cannot lift the cover alone." She looked puzzled.
"That is strange. Maybe there is something wrong with the pump in the well, but it was working perfectly when I tested it a few days ago. Come, we shall see."
I followed her through the garden to a small shelter behind my little house.
"Come, we shall lift the cover together," she said.
I took one side and she the other, and we lifted it.
"Now, let us see what is the matter," she said.
We peered inside. I'm not sure which of us screamed. I heard the sound piercing through my head, and I know my own mouth was open. A man's body had been jammed into the top of the well.
Chapter 18. Hugo. December 1944. Miraculously, the aspirin did seem to bring down Hugo's fever a little. He felt like a limp rag, but remembering Sophia's stern admonition, he forced himself to sip at the soup. Then he lay back gasping, his forehead beaded with sweat. "What will happen now?" he worried. What if gangrene had set in and his leg had to be amputated? It was obvious he'd never make it past the Germans to the Allies, and Sophia had been right. If the Germans came upon him in this condition, they would see him as a hindrance and a liability, and would dispatch him instantly. He realized there was little hope of surviving. He wondered if he should do the right thing, and try to make his way down to that road below and await his fate, rather than risk any more visits from Sophia. When he tried to get up, nausea and dizziness overwhelmed him. He realized he could not go anywhere in this state. That was when he took out his service revolver and examined it, turning it over in his hand. He could end his life now. That would be the best thing to do, the noble way out. He felt the heaviness of the revolver, pictured how he'd point it at his temple, hold it steady, and click, all over. But he hesitated, not from fear of ending his life, but because he didn't want Sophia to find his head blown away. He didn't want to leave without saying goodbye. "If the leg gets worse," he told himself, "if gangrene really sets in, then I'll do it. But I'll tell her what I'm going to do, and why it is the only solution." Then he lay back and fell into a restless, fevered sleep. He wasn't sure how many days passed this way. He was vaguely aware that she came again, that she cleaned his wound with something that stung so badly he had screamed. He remembered she had held his head, made him swallow some kind of medicine, wiped the sweat from his brow, and tried to make him take some warm soup. But he remembered these things as part of unquiet dreams, not sure they had actually happened. So it was a surprise for him to open his eyes one bright morning and find that he felt comfortably warm and the fever had departed. As he came back to full consciousness, he realized he had a real pillow under his head, a sheepskin over him, and something tied to his wrist. He held up his arm and saw it was a medal, a religious medal to some kind of saint. "Whatever it is, it certainly worked," he thought. He attempted to extricate himself from the cocoon that had been wound around him. Even that small task was beyond him, and he lay back before attempting again. This time he succeeded. He freed himself, wriggled out of his shelter, and felt the coldness of the stone floor against his body. He tried to stand, but gave up when the room swung around him and he felt horribly nauseous. He sipped a little water and took a few bites of the bread that had been left on the bench beside him. When he plucked up the courage to examine his wound, he went to take down his trousers and was astounded to see that they were not his own. They were made of coarse black wool, and he was wearing different underpants, too. She had changed his clothes for him, while he'd slept like a baby. He turned his face toward the wall, his cheeks burning, feeling horribly embarrassed and ashamed, even though he'd had no part in this. Carefully, he pulled back the trouser leg until he came to the bandage. It was no longer soaked in blood, which was a good sign, and the wound didn't smell bad, which was even better. He unwound the bandage and peeled back the pad from the wound. It wasn't a pretty sight, with part of his flesh blown away, but it wasn't too awful either. It was clearly healing. He washed it with the remains of the water, then applied a clean pad and reapplied the bandage. Then he arranged himself in his hiding place and waited for Sophia to come. He glanced at his watch, but it had stopped. Of course, he hadn't wound it for days. From the position of the shadows on the wall, he could tell it was still early morning. In the distance, he heard a church bell ringing, followed almost immediately by one closer by. More than the tolling of the hour this time, the bells went on and on until the air echoed with the sound. "Sunday," he thought. "It must be Sunday," and felt comforted that all around him people were going to church to pray. He had never been much for God himself. Members of the British aristocracy went to church as a display of solidarity with the lower classes around them, but didn't actually believe. At least his father didn't. He had once said to Hugo,
When you've been in the trenches and watched men blown apart or drowning in mud, you can't believe that any god would let those things happen and not interfere.
And yet Sophia had tied the saint's medal to his wrist, and it seemed to have worked. He tried a tentative prayer.
Dear God,
if you're there, and you can hear me, keep her safe. Let me get home somehow. Protect Langley Hall and those in it. And, dear God, protect Sophia and her family. He was going to add, let her husband still be alive and come back to her. But he couldn't say the words. The bells died away to silence. He fished for his packet of cigarettes. There were 12 left from the 20. He lit one, lay back and smoked it, watching the vapour hanging in the frigid air. The day was quite still. No birdsong, no wind, no dogs barking. Utter stillness. It felt as if he was the only person in the world. He wondered when she would come. He suspected she wouldn't go out looking for mushrooms on a Sunday. He remembered from his own time in Italy that Sundays had been times for church and big family meals. Not that she had much food or much of a family, but she'd be obliged to stay with them. He felt empty and hungry, so he finished the bread that was already becoming stale. A pigeon flapped and fluttered across the top of the wall, and he wished he had the strength to get up and set that trap. But he hadn't. A watery sun rose higher in the sky. The day passed. The sun sank again, and still she didn't come. He fought with disappointment. Of course she couldn't come on a Sunday. He'd already realized that. Maybe she'd slip away in the dark again, although he didn't like the idea of her walking alone through the olive groves when there might be Germans or partisans or black marketeers prowling around. He lit his candle, but eventually blew it out, afraid of wasting it. He lay awake, listening to the night sounds, the hoot of an owl, the sigh of the wind. She won't come now, he told himself. And then the worries crept in. Had something happened to her? Someone had seen her coming through the olive groves and betrayed her. He tried to shut out the dark thoughts, but they would not subside. He must have drifted off into dreams, because he awoke with a start, at a loud sound close by, and reached for his weapon.
It is only me, Ugo, said a gentle voice. Do not be afraid.
And he watched her lantern bobbing toward him across the floor. She placed the lantern on the bench and dropped to her knees beside him, her face glowing with joy in the candlelight.
You are awake and sitting up. That is such good news. I was so worried. Each time I came back I expected to find you dead. But I entrusted you to the care of Saint Rita.
Saint Rita? Who is she?
She is the patron saint of wounds.
This is the medal you tied to my wrist.
Of course, she said. She did well for you, did she not?
Well, I'm feeling much better, he said. The fever has gone and the wound is beginning to heal. I can't thank you enough, Sophia. You have taken such good care of me. You've even changed my clothes, like an infant. She smiled.
I could not let you lie there in such a state. I took your own clothes away and have cleaned them. I will bring them back next time.
And what I'm wearing now belongs to Guido?
Of course. He's not here to use them. Rather you than the moths.
He took her hand. I will make all this up to you, I promise. When I am home, I will send you money for new clothes, good soft wool.
Let us not talk of such things, she said. Who knows what tomorrow will bring? Nothing good, I feel. But eat. I've brought you soup. You must be hungry.
She unwrapped the bowl, and he ate it eagerly. It wasn't much of a soup, really. Some cabbage and carrot leaves and a few beans. As if reading his thoughts, she said,
I know it is not much. We haven't had any meat for days now. But it is warm.
You are too good to share what little you have with me, he said. She turned away.
I do not know how long I can keep on coming here, she said. The Germans were in my village today. You heard the church bells?
I thought it was Sunday.
No. Each village rings the bell when Germans approach. That way the young men in the village know to go and hide in the woods, and the young women hide wherever they can. I was up in my attic all day, hidden in an old wardrobe.
She paused, her eyes holding his, begging him to understand her.
These men are animals, Ugo, she said. The war has turned them into animals. We women fear for our honor every time they come near. They took the baker's daughter once, a young girl of 15, and they violated her, one after the other. She has never been the same since. Her mind snapped at the horror of it.
Oh, how terrible. I'm so very sorry.
I can assure you that British soldiers would not behave in that way. She gave a wonderfully Italian shrug.
Who can say? Some of these men were undoubtedly good boys at home. They helped the family in the fields, or they worked in banks and took girls dancing. But the war has changed them, ruined them.
Are the Germans still there? She shook her head.
No, saints be praised. They came to see if our village was a good place to wait out the winter. Their army has established a line just north of here, and they are looking for places where they can defend the roads from the south, from where the Allies will come. But I am glad to say that the views from our village did not meet their liking. And as we have nothing worth taking any more, they left. Actually, that is not true. They took the mayor's remaining chickens. May their souls rot in hell.
A gust of wind swept in, making the candle in her lantern flicker and sending shadows dancing.
So you're safe for a while?
Maybe. We hope that they will have news of the Allies advancing, and they will flee back to Germany and leave us in peace. But some say the Allies will not advance until the spring now. The snows will come, and the roads will be impassable in the mountains.
That means I will be trapped here until the spring, too.
We do not often get snow. Our hills are not so high. But there are very high mountains between here and the coast. Maybe when your leg is strong enough, we can find a way to get you to the south. We have no motor cars and no petrol, but there are farm carts, and those who grow produce take them to market.
What produce do they grow in the winter? He asked.
Root vegetables, turnips, potatoes, cauliflower, cabbage. Although the Germans have helped themselves to all our cabbages. They love cabbage for some reason. I have some turnips and parsnips almost ready for harvest on my small plot of land.
Well, that's good. And how is the search for mushrooms going? She sighed.
I fear I cannot use that excuse any longer. There will be no more mushrooms now. And I think I have found every single one. I will have to sneak out in the middle of the night, as I have just done.
I'm feeling better now. Really, Sophia, you do not need to come so often. If you could come once in a while and leave me a little something to eat, I'll get by.
Don't be silly. How will you get well and strong if you don't eat? There is a new moon in the sky. Soon it will be easy to walk without a lantern, and I wear dark clothes. Nobody will see me, don't worry.
What time is it anyway?
After one. I could not leave before I was sure all the Germans had gone. They found some bottles of wine in the mayor's cellar, and they stayed late, singing their stupid songs.
But you will get no sleep. You will make yourself ill.
She patted his hand.
Don't worry. Most nights the village is asleep by 9. It is only women and children. The men who remain go off with the partisans to do what harm they can to the Germans by night.
Are all the men part of the resistance?
Who knows? We do not ask and they do not tell us. Better that way, if the Germans question anyone. All I can tell you is that partisans are active nearby. And it is possible that our local men are involved. Not that there are many men in the village any longer. The few that are here were with the army in the south, fighting beside the Germans until we changed sides. Then they slipped away before the Germans could conscript them, or send them to prison camps. They are brave boys, I am sure. Although I am glad that they are off doing their destructive work. That Cosimo is a little too interested in me.
Cosimo?
His voice was harsh. She nodded.
Some whisper that he is a leader in the partisans. No doubt a brave fellow. Not bad-looking. A powerful man. But I told him until my husband is declared dead, I am still married to him. All the same, he has been hanging around lately. He brings us an occasional egg or flask of wine, and we don't ask where he got it. But I think they are an excuse to visit me, so I am glad that he is away for days at a time.
He would not try... Hugo forced out the words.
Oh, no, nothing like that. He is an honorable man, I am sure. He is kind to my son, but I do not wish to be courted by him.
When I escape, you must come with me, Hugo said. She smiled sadly.
But what if Guido returned home to find I was not there? And I cannot leave his grandmother. I promised him when he went away that I would take care of her.
He wanted to say something more, but every thought seemed so hopeless. So he asked, Is there a saint for everything?
Oh, yes,
she said simply.
Saint Anne, for those wishing to have a child. Saint Blaise, for throats. A saint for rheumatism, for chilblains.
He laughed, then asked, And one to protect women and children?
We ask La Madonna for that,
she answered.
She lost her own son. She saw him die. She knows how we feel.
Do you wear a medal of La Madonna?
I gave mine to Guido when he went away,
she said.
I only pray that it kept him safe and that he is still alive. But I fear it is not so. My heart tells me that he is dead.
Hugo took her hand. She gripped his fiercely, and they sat close together in the small circle of flickering light, sharing their worry.
Chapter 19 Joanna June 1973 Angelina was woken up and sent to fetch the carabinieri. Two men in impressive military-style uniforms arrived, red-faced from running down the hill. It took them some time to extract the body, so firmly was it jammed into the well. When they laid it out on the gravel path, I gave a little gasp of horror. It was Gianni, the man who had offered to escort me home last night, only to be pushed aside in favor of the more reliable Alberto. The two carabinieri agents recognized him instantly. "But surely this is Gianni," one said, and they exchanged a look I couldn't quite understand. A doctor was summoned and pronounced that Gianni had been struck on the back of the head with a blunt object. He had then been pushed into the well with his head under the water. The cause of death was drowning. I found I couldn't stop shivering. It was too horrible to contemplate. Paola took one look at me and put an arm around my shoulder. "The poor young lady is in shock, and she has not even had her breakfast yet. Come, my dear, let me pour you some coffee and you will feel better." "And who is this young lady?" one of the policemen asked. "She's a visitor from England," Paola said. "She has newly arrived here and stays at my guest house." "This is the guest house?" the officer asked, pointing at my open door. "It is," Paola confirmed. "So close to the well," said the officer, a rather unpleasant-looking, pudgy individual with little piggy eyes, staring at me. "You sleep there, signorina, and yet you heard nothing when this man was murdered?" "I heard nothing," I said. He asked another question. This time the Italian was beyond me. "I'm sorry, I only speak a little of your language," I said. "I will understand if you speak slowly." "I asked who found the body," he repeated. My brain was refusing to function properly. I couldn't think clearly in English, let alone form sentences in Italian. "The signora and I found it," I stammered, waving my arms as one does when speaking a foreign language and lacking the vocabulary. "I wanted to take a shower. There was no water. I went to the well, but..." It took me long enough to say these words. Then my Italian failed me. "She was not strong enough to remove the cover alone, so she came for me and together we lifted the cover," Paola said. "We both saw the body at the same time, and I think we both screamed. We were certainly both alarmed." "Do you know this man?" the other officer asked. "I know him," Paola said, "as well as you do. He has lived in San Salvatore all his life. But this young lady does not. I told you, she has newly arrived here."
And do you have any idea why Gianni may have chosen to hang around your house at night?
There was a sneer to the voice of the unpleasant Carabinieri.
Certainly not to court me, Paola said hotly. Of course, we know no reason. Signorina Langley and my daughter Angelina and I were enjoying our dinner together, and then we went to bed. That is the story of our evening. As to how this man wound up in my well, I would say it is likely that he was knocked out on the path on his way out of town, and that my well appealed to his attackers as a good place to hide his body, because my house was closest to the path.
We can make no assumptions yet, one of them said. You will both be required to come up to our headquarters in the town and make an official statement. Later, there will be further inquiries. It may be that the inspector from the municipal decides to come from Lucca, since this is clearly a murder investigation. You are not to leave this place without permission. Is that clear?
I hadn't managed to follow this, but I understood more when Paola said,
I have no intention of going anywhere. But this young lady, she may have to return to her homeland quite soon. She is not to be held up by a murder investigation about which she knows nothing.
As for that, we shall see when we have made further inquiries, the fat one said. For the time being, she is to remain here. Understood?
I nodded. The full implications of this were just sinking in. The men at that table would undoubtedly be questioned. They would say that Gianni wanted to walk me home, but I refused. They might say that Gianni flirted with me. I could see that a warped imagination might read several scenarios into that. Perhaps they would all like to be able to pin a murder on an outsider. I felt sick. Paola didn't seem at all perturbed.
I'll leave your men to go about your business and have this man's body removed from my premises, she said. As for my well, I suppose my water is now contaminated. Poor Signorina Langley certainly won't want to take her shower until it has been treated. Come, my dear, you shall use the bathroom at the farmhouse and have a good long soak in my tub. Our water comes from the mains.
With that, she put an arm firmly around my shoulder and led me away from the crime scene.
Don't let them upset you, she said as she closed the kitchen door behind us. Those men are bullies. They are not from around here. The Carabinieri are only country policemen, always chosen from among the uncouth and the loutish. Many of them come from Sicily, and we know what kind of people live down there, don't we? Gangsters, mafiosi. Still, they are not permitted by law to investigate major crimes. With luck, a senior inspector from Lucca will be sent, and all will be well. But first, let me pour you coffee. And you should have a good breakfast before you take your bath.
Angelina had been standing just outside the kitchen door, watching from a distance with the baby in her arms. As we approached, the baby started to cry. Angelina rocked her back and forth.
Have those horrible men gone yet, Mamma? She asked. Is it true that someone was murdered? I did not like to come closer in case the shock curdled my milk and I could not feed the little one.
It is true, mia cara, Paola said. The poor man who lost his life was Gianni.
Oh, Gianni.
Angelina nodded thoughtfully as she put the baby to her shoulder and patted its back.
Well, I suppose that is not a complete shock, is it?
It is always a shock when someone dies before their time, Paola said. Go put the little one down and we will have our breakfast. This poor young lady is shivering as if she has been out in the snow.
She sat me at the table as if I was a helpless child, put a cup of milky coffee in front of me, and then placed bread and jam and cheese on the table.
Eat. You will feel better.
My stomach felt as if it had tied itself into knots, and I didn't think I could eat anything. But with Paola hovering over and watching me, I had to at least take some sips of hot coffee, and then spread some apricot jam on a slice of bread. The bread must have been baked that morning. It was still warm, and the butter and fresh apricot jam melted together so that I almost sighed with pleasure at the combination of textures and flavors. Who could have thought that bread and jam could have such an effect? I had a second slice, then some sharp cheese,
and by that time I was feeling almost human again, and strong enough to tackle even the most boorish carabinieri. Angelina came to join us, cutting herself a big hunk of bread and topping it with lashings of butter. "Why did you say you were not shocked that Gianni was killed?" I asked her. She shrugged. "It is said that sometimes Gianni makes deals, not quite legal ones, you know? Maybe cigarettes from a boat that comes to the coast? That sort of thing."
"We don't know that," Paola said. "It is all hearsay. It is true he is not liked in town, not trusted. And now this business with the olive press."
"He wanted to get men together to build his own olive press, is that right?" I asked. She nodded.
"And of course Cosimo would not be happy if that came to pass. But I don't think it would ever have happened. The other men would not have wanted to risk defying Cosimo. I think Gianni stuck his neck out for nothing."
I tried to make sense of this. Not just their Italian words, but the implications of them. Gianni was involved in things that were not quite legal, and shoving someone down a well to drown would be the sort of thing that gangsters would do to teach someone a lesson. But he had also dared to cross Cosimo. I pictured that man's face, so powerful, and his eyes so cold when he stared at me and said,
"You are German, I think."
No, I would not have wanted to cross him. But he'd had a stroke, which had clearly left him partly paralyzed, certainly not able to lift that extremely heavy top from the well and shove a body down into it. But then someone as powerful as Cosimo probably had minions who would obey his commands. And he had an adopted son who was big and muscular. I had to remember that.
"Tomorrow is Saturday," Paola said. "Market day in San Salvatore. You shall both help me see which vegetables and fruits are ready to be picked and brought to market."
"Don't we have to go up to the town and make our statements at the police station?" I said. Paola gave a dismissive gesture.
"Pah! Let those men wait. We know nothing about Gianni's activities that might have led to his untimely death. It will be good for us to have something to do, and working out in God's nature is always soothing for the soul."
She put a hand on my shoulder.
"Why don't we do that right now, before the sun is too hot, and then you can take your bath at your leisure?"
I would have liked to bathe first, having hastily pulled on yesterday's clothes, but I wasn't going to argue with Paola when she was being so kind to me. I followed her out to the garden.
"Let us see," she said. "These tomatoes. Yes, we shall find enough ripe ones here, but we will not pick them until the last minute tomorrow. And these broad beans, they must be eaten young like this. The pole beans, they will take another couple of weeks."
She paused, bending to a feathery plant.
"The asparagus, we want to keep enough for ourselves, but the plant has been generous this year. Good."
She continued onward, moving with speed and grace for a large woman.
"Ah, look, Angelina, the zucchini blossoms. Perfect."
I saw her examine a yellow flower. "What do you do with those?" I asked. "Can you eat flowers?"
"Oh, but yes, zucchini blossoms. We stuff them. So delicious. I will make some for us tonight if you like. And then this plant will keep rewarding us with zucchini all season long."
I had just seen something else I hadn't expected to find in this well-cultivated plot. It looked like a giant thistle. "But surely one cannot eat this?" I asked, pointing at it. Paola looked surprised.
"You do not have artichokes in your country?"
"I've never seen anything like this before."
"Then I will fry some tonight as an antipasto. Oh, but they are good. You will enjoy."
We walked on. We found that there were ripe cherries and even some apricots, but that the peaches would not be ready for a while.
"We will pick the fruit tonight after the sun goes down. And the asparagus can be cut too, but the tomatoes, the blossoms, those will wait until the last minute to pick."
She gave us a satisfied smile.
"Good. We will have a fine offering at the market tomorrow."
And we followed her back to the house. I went back to my room to collect my sponge bag and towel, looking forward to a long soak in a tub. As I rummaged in my bag for clean underwear, I noticed a piece of paper sticking out from between the slats of the shutter on my window. It certainly hadn't been in the room yesterday. I went over and pulled it free with some difficulty. It was an envelope. I sat on my bed and opened it. As I took out a letter, three objects fell onto the quilt. I examined them one by one. One was a little lapel pin in the shape of a many-pointed star. Another was a scrap of brown cloth, stiff with something like paint. And the third was a small banknote. It said Reichsmark, a German banknote from the time of the war. I put them back onto the quilt and tried to read the letter. The handwriting was not easy to read, and my knowledge of written Italian was not great. I went for my dictionary and started to translate slowly and laboriously. I want to tell you the truth about Sophia. I know. I kept silent until now, for fear of my life. But you are an outsider. I will take you to my sheep, and there I will tell you, where nobody can hear us. It wasn't signed, but it had to be from Gianni. He had invited me to visit his sheep last night. I found that my hand that held the letter was shaking. I looked at the objects on my bed. I had no idea what any of it meant, but I was frightened. Had Gianni been killed because he was going to tell me the truth about what happened during the war? Chapter 20. Joanna. June 1973. I picked up the three objects from my bed, examining them in my hand and wondering what they could mean. The German banknote was easy enough to understand. German money. Someone had been paid German money. But the other two? I stared at the piece of stiffened cloth. It was dark brown. I lifted it up and sniffed for the smell of paint, then recoiled. It was not paint. It had a faintly metallic smell. Surely it was blood. Hastily, I scooped up the three things and shoved them into the toe of one of my spare shoes, where they would be safely hidden. Then I folded the letter and put it back inside the envelope, which I carefully placed between the pages of my dictionary, just in case. I could tell nobody. That was clear. Not even Paola. She must not be put in danger. I realized now that Gianni had been trying to get me alone last night, not for an amorous encounter, but because he wanted to tell me something. He knew the truth about Sophia. He must have known about my father. And this was enough to get him killed. I stared through the bars on my window out into the blindingly bright sunshine. Had he been followed here last night? Had someone seen him push the envelope through the bars and shutters of my window, and then hit him over the head? In which case I was in danger. It occurred to me that I should have just left the envelope where I had found it, so that anyone who came to search would realize that I was completely unaware of its contents. But it was too late for that now. The most sensible thing for me to do would be to go back to Florence and take the next train home. Once I was out of the country, I would be safe. But the two policemen had said I was not allowed to leave the area until I was given permission. There was no bus I could take, and anyone who gave me a lift could get into trouble for abetting my escape. I was trapped here. I would have to make sure I stayed close to Paola. She would not let anything happen to me. I collected my sponge bag and towel and almost ran back to the house.
"You are indeed eager for your bath," Paola commented,
noting I was breathing hard.
"Relax, my little one. Forget about what you have seen. Forget about those men. Gianni and his mistakes are nothing to do with us. May God have mercy on his soul, and also on his poor wife, who is now left alone. She will now be like me, unable to take care of the sheep and make cheese. I must go and offer her comfort. But not today. She may not even know the truth yet. Poor soul."
Paola took me through a long tiled hallway and ushered me into an enormous bathroom with a big clawfoot tub against one wall. She turned on the water and ran it until it reached the correct temperature. Then she nodded with satisfaction.
"Good," she said. "Take your time. Enjoy it. Let your cares be washed away."
While the bath was filling, I cleaned my teeth. I certainly wasn't going to use the water from that well for anything other than flushing the toilet. I lowered myself into the warm water, lay back, and stared at the high ceiling. But I couldn't relax. I was glad to see that there were also bars on this window. I was safe for a while, at least. After I had bathed, I was relieved to find that Paola and Angelina were working in the garden, picking the broad beans. They were within hailing distance if I needed them. They could also see anyone coming down the path from the town. I dressed, put my dictionary into my purse, and came out to see if I could help with the picking.
"The rest we will leave until it is cool this evening," Paola said. "Now I suppose we must go up to the town, or those brutes will come looking for us. Let us get it over with."
I followed them into the house. Paola took off her apron and put on her hat before we set off up the hill. As we came into the piazza, we found it abuzz with people. We were besieged the moment we were spotted. Most of the Italian was too fast for me to understand, and spoken in the local Tuscan dialect, but I got the meaning. Was it true that Gianni had been murdered, found in Paola's well, and she heard nothing? No cries for help? Who could have done such a thing? At this last question, looks were exchanged.
"Well, that Gianni,"
a woman said, leaning in closer as if she didn't want her words to be heard beyond our little group.
"He was maybe asking for trouble. My husband warned him when that man showed up looking for him. Remember, I told you."
There were nods all around.
"And that time he had that grappa for sale. Who knows where that came from? Certainly not from around here."
I could see relief in all those faces. Not from around here. His death had nothing to do with anyone in San Salvatore.
"We have to go to the Carabinieri and make a statement," Paola said. "Good luck with that,"
one of the men who had been loitering at the edge of our circle said.
"You go in that place, and you're lucky to come out again."
They chuckled, but I could see they also glanced over at the yellow building.
"Don't say that in front of the English signorina," one of them said. "She will not believe you're joking." "Tell her she will be fine as long as she leaves a good bribe,"
the man said.
"Don't talk like that,"
a woman in black turned and gave him a hefty shove.
"Shouldn't you be minding your shop, not meddling where you are not wanted?"
The man shuffled away. Paola took my arm and marched me toward the open door of the Carabinieri building.
"Pay no attention. That man is a troublemaker," she said. "He is as bad as Gianni was. He sold some of the illegal grappa at his shop, didn't he? Claims he didn't know there was anything wrong with it."
We went up three steps and into the cool darkness beyond. It smelled of stale smoke in there. The room we went into was lit only by a small, high window with bars on it. I felt as though I had stepped into a prison cell. I glanced nervously at Paola. She didn't seem at all worried.
"So we have come to make our statements. Let us get it over with. I have much work to do with market day tomorrow," she said.
One of the officers we had seen this morning was seated at a desk.
"Ah, you came. Good. Just tell the truth and all will be well," he said. "Of course we will tell the truth because we have nothing to tell," Paola said. "It is not my fault that some man chooses to meet his end on my property. So, where is some paper? Where is a pen? We do not have time to waste."
A sheet of paper was produced, and the officer pointed to a chair for Paola to sit. When he tried to give me a sheet of paper, I shook my head. "I can't write in Italian," I said. "I don't speak it well either." I thought at this moment it might be better if they thought of me as a stranger who understood little and therefore could have no connection with what went on in San Salvatore.
"All right."
The officer picked up a pen and looked up at me.
"How long have you been in San Salvatore?"
"I only arrived yesterday," I told him. "No, I have never been here before. I have never been to Italy before. I know nobody in the town. I was told that Signora Rossini had a room to rent. That is why I'm staying there."
"And why did you come to San Salvatore?"
he asked, frowning at me.
"We have no antiquities here, no famous church. We are not Siena or Florence."
I tried to think of a reason for coming that would not involve my father or the war. An innocent reason. I was a student of agriculture and writing a paper on olive trees. But then I realized that someone would have told them that I was asking questions about Sofia Bartoli and my father. It was better to tell the truth. I had nothing to hide, except for a letter concealed in my dictionary. My father was a British airman, I said, those words now coming easily to me as I had said them several times. His plane was shot down near this town. I wanted to see it for myself because he died recently.
Ah.
That seemed to satisfy him.
I understand. And this man who was killed, you did not know him?
I only came here yesterday, I said. I think he was among the men who were kind to me when I asked about my father. They bought me a glass of wine here in the piazza. Then I went home to dinner with Signora Rossini, and after dinner I was very tired. I fell asleep early. This morning I wanted to wash, but there was no water. That was when I asked the Signora, and she helped me lift the lid on the well, and we saw the body. That is all I know.
Very good, Signorina, he said.
I could see that his expression was now relaxed. I was not a suspect. Am I free to go if I wish? I asked. He shook his head.
We have had to report this to the detectives in Lucca. They will send an inspector, and he will want to confirm what you have told me. A mere formality, you understand, but until he comes, you must remain here.
And when might he come? I asked. I have to go back to England. He gave an expressive shrug.
It is Saturday tomorrow, is it not? Perhaps he will come then, or perhaps he will wait until Monday. We have to see.
I tried to tell myself there was no harm in my waiting around for 2 more days. I'd be with Paola. I'd be safe. Then my hand tightened around the purse I was carrying. Had someone observed Gianni push the envelope through the bars? In which case, what lengths would they go to in order to recover it from me? I should have resealed it and left it in my room, I thought. But then I decided that nobody could get into that room unless they managed to break down the heavy door. I followed Paola out into the dazzling sunshine.
That is finished, thank la Madonna, she said. Now to more important matters. I think we should go to the butcher's and buy some veal for tonight's dinner. You like veal?
I don't think I've ever had it, I said, not even knowing what the word meant.
What do you eat in England? She asked. Always roast beef?
No, we eat lamb, sausages, fish, and potatoes. Always potatoes, not pasta. She gave me a look of intense pity.
That is why you are all skin and bones, she said. You must stay with me long enough for me to fatten you up. Who will want to marry a girl with no meat on her?
I wasn't always skin and bones, I said. I have been sick this year.
Ah, that explains why you look like a walking statue. You stay here, my dear, and you will see what sunshine and good food can do for you.
It was a very tempting offer. At this moment I could think of nothing better than staying with Paola, learning to cook, being mothered by her. Except that a man had been killed, and it may have been because I was in San Salvatore. He had written that he knew the truth about Sophia. Did that mean that someone else in the village knew the truth and wanted it to remain hidden? I looked around the piazza. At this hour of the morning, the tables outside the trattoria were empty. The only people around were housewives doing their shopping with baskets over their arms, and some small children chasing the pigeons that wheeled and flapped and settled again. On the church tower above, the bell started tolling. I thought it was for the hour, but it went on ringing. Paola crossed herself.
The Angelus. It is midday. Come, we must hurry before the shops shut for lunch, and that lazy butcher will not open again until at least 4.
She set off at a great pace. I almost had to run to keep up. We bought some pale little chops of what I had now worked out must be veal. Then in the delicatessen next door, she chose several salamis from among the hundreds arranged on the shelf and some white cheese.
Now we go home to eat, she said, nodding in satisfaction. You shall help me stuff the zucchini blossoms.
We arrived back at her house.
First we pick, and then we stuff, she said.
I'll go and put my purse away, I said, then I'll help you. I took the key and wended my way through the market garden to my little house. The door was still locked and untouched. I heaved a sigh of relief. I let myself in and checked that the 3 objects were still in my shoe. I left my purse and locked the door behind me. As I glanced over at the window, I noticed the imprint of a big boot in the soft earth. Had that been there this morning? I didn't think so, but I wasn't sure I would have noticed. Was it maybe Gianni's print from last night? But I remembered he had been quite slickly dressed, light blue shirt open at the neck and tight black trousers. Certainly no